Good afternoon, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call the Senate Finance Committee to order. The time is 5:58 p.m., April 11, 2012. And today, or this evening, I'm joined by my co-chair, Senator Hoffman, Senator Olson, Senator Thomas, Senator Egan, Senator McGuire, and myself, Stedman, and we'll be shortly joined by Senator Ellis, who's in a brief meeting. We're going to have two bills on the agenda this evening. We're going to bring up Senate Bill 25, ADA Sustainable Energy Program, followed by Senate Bill 192, Oil and Gas Production Tax. The previously posted agenda dealing with three House bills, House Bill 302, 366, and House Concurrent Resolution, will be postponed till tomorrow. So with that, I'd like to go ahead and start with Senate Bill 25 by Senator McGuire regarding the ADA Sustainable Energy Program. This is the second hearing on this bill. We heard it for the first time, March 29th. My intent today is to bring the bill back for the purposes of adopting a committee substitute and look to the will of the committee. Senator Hoffman, may I have a motion to adopt the committee substitute version S? This one's Sam.
Move the city, the committee, Senate Finance Committee adopts CS for sponsor substitute for Senate Bill 25 / S as our working document.
I'll object for explanation and ask Mr. Peterson for my staff to come forward, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Darwin Peterson, staff to the Senate Finance Committee. The committee substitute version S you just adopted, and the changes that are found in that version of the bill. First of all, Mr. Chairman, we added sections 3, 4, and 5. These new sections will exclude the value of the leasehold interest on ADA-owned properties for the purpose of determining the full and true value by the state, only if the local government chooses to exempt that property from taxation. ADA owns five major properties in Alaska that are leased to private operators. These are the aircraft maintenance facility at the Ted Stevens International Airport in the municipality of Anchorage, the Skagway Ore Terminal in the municipality of Skagway, the Ketchikan Shipyard in the Ketchikan Gateway Borough, the Red Dog Road and Port in the Northwest Arctic Borough, and the Snedisham Hydro Dam and Power Station in the city and borough of Juneau. The full and true value determination is important to municipal governments in a number of ways. It determines the magnitude of the required local contribution component of state education aid. It impacts the required local share for school construction and school major maintenance. It affects the amount of federal impact aid to which a municipal school district is entitled. And it limits property tax and capacity. The exemption of the Red Dog Road and Port from the determination of the full and true value has allowed the Northwest Arctic Borough to avoid a loss of education funding estimated at $1 million annually. That was passed in 2010. So this legislation will just treat all the rest of the ADA-owned properties equally. The municipalities will have the choice. If they choose to continue to impose property taxes on those leasehold interests, then they will not get the reduction of their in their local education contribution. Otherwise, they can choose to exempt that property and they will receive that reduction. Those are the changes in sections 3, 4, and 5, Mr. Chairman. Continuing on, we removed previous section 5, which was simply changing the word chairman to chair in AS 4488105D. In section 8, on page 6, line 28, we replaced the term energy project with qualified energy development and made the same change in section 7. On page 7, line 23, and on section 9, page 8, line 20, as well as everywhere that it appeared in section 16 of the bill. We deleted the word energy preceding the word loan everywhere that that appeared, which is page 9, lines 17, 19, and 28, and on page 10, lines 2 and 11. Under the powers and duties of the authority in section 16, we added new language on page 12, lines 24 through 28. This new language authorizes ADA to pay off the principal and interest on bonds for municipal utilities. The utilities would then be required to continue making their normal bond payments to ADA, which will be held in a sinking fund for each municipality and those funds can be used in the future for qualified energy projects, energy expansion. Section 17, Mr. Chairman, the definition of qualified energy development was amended by removing three subsections, those being subsection C, which was conversion of natural gas, coal, or biomass to liquids, subsection D, which was processing, refining, or upgrading of oil, and subsection F, which was enhanced oil recovery or carbon sequestration. Finally, a repealer in section 18 on page 13, line 26 was added. This is the session law that excluded the Red Dog Road and Port from full and true value determination only until November 30th, 2012. By repealing this session law, the leasehold interest in the ADA-owned properties of the Red Dog Road and Port will continue to be excluded from the determination of full and true value. That concludes the changes in this committee substitute, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. I'll go ahead and remove my objection to the adoption of the CS. Is there further objection to the adoption of the CS? Seeing none, version S is our working document in front of us. Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't have much further to add other than I think the additions are good. We've reduced the amount somewhat in terms of capitalizing the fund, and I think it's appropriate considering where we are in our financial times. I do believe the amount that's invested will grow the economy, but I think it's a good idea to start out with a measured approach. I'm excited already. We've had phone calls from people all across the globe who are interested in contributing venture capital and partnering in some of these projects, and I think it, again, as I stated earlier, takes up where we left off in our energy package with outright grants. I like the sideboards in it. I think it requires those that come forward to go through that creditworthiness analysis so that there's skin in the game and that we know that it's a viable project. And as we look forward to the future, with the next bill that we're taking up, I hope that we can continue to grow our oil and gas economy, but I think Alaskans have to prepare for that day where our economy will be diversified. And I hope that this will contribute to that. And I sincerely appreciate the work of Mr. Peterson and yourself. And thank you to the committee members for all their support.
And for those watching at home, just so we don't leave a gap, this establishes a sustainable energy and transmission supply development program so we can try to generate more electricity and more energy to the state and distribute it is what we're trying to do. Do we have further questions for the Senator Hoffman?
I don't have no questions.
Okay, I've got two fiscal notes in your packets. 1-0 fiscal note from the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development. There's one fiscal note from the Senate Finance Committee to capitalize the Sustainable Energy Transmission and Supply Development Fund in the amount of $125 million for FY13. A fiscal note from the Department of Education and Early Development reflecting the changes made in Section 3, 4, and 5 is forthcoming. We've previously had public testimony. Senator Hoffman.
Mr. Chairman, I move the Senate Finance Committee pass CS for sponsor substitute for Senate Bill 25 from committee to the next committee of referral with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes.
We have a motion to move the bill from committee with individual recommendations, the attached two fiscal notes, and the one forthcoming. Do we have objection? Seeing none, we'll move the bill from committee to the next committee of the referral. Next up, Senate Bill 192, oil and gas production. We're going to take a brief at ease while we set up for the presentation. We're at ease. Come back from recess. Next up, Senate Bill 192, Oil and Gas Production Tax. The intent today is to adopt a committee substitute and look to the will of the committee. Senator Hoffman, we have a motion to adopt committee substitute version Y.
Mr. Chairman, I move the Senate Finance Committee adopt CS for Senate Bill 192/Y as our working document.
And I'll object for explanation. And Mr. Peterson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Darwin Peterson, staff of the Senate Finance Committee. First change is located on page 5 of the bill. Subsection A, which starts on line 10, is the subsection that deals with the incremental production above the producer's targeted decline rate. Previously, that the trigger price on progressivity for incremental production was at $60, the same as it was for existing production. That has now been changed. If you look on line 12 and line 14, the trigger price for the gross value point of production is now $75 instead of $60. I made that conforming change in subsection B, found on line 18 and line 21. Starting on line 23 of the same page, this deals with new production. Previously, a producer was given 7 years at the lowest progressivity rate for new production. We've extended that out to 10 years, which is reflected on line 23 and 24. In the last line, line 31, we increased the progressivity trigger for the price of a barrel of oil for the new production to $90. As opposed to previous was also $60. Finally, Mr. Chairman, on page 6, in section 4, this is the adjustment of the trigger price for progressivity for the calculation of the CPI. We've now added the $75 trigger price for incremental production and the $90 trigger price for new production into this calculation for adjusting the CPI. That concludes the changes, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Peterson. I'll remove my objection for the adoption of the CS. Do we have any further objection to the adoption of the CS? Seeing none, version Y is adopted as our working document. I'd like to have representation from PFC Energy come forward, please. For those watching at home, PFC Energy is consulting firm, and I'll have them briefly define the firm for those watching that haven't seen the other presentations before. They're hired by Legislative Budget Audit, which is a joint committee of the House and the Senate that handles our consultant contracts. So they're working for the legislature to advise the legislature on this particular issue of oil and gas tax structure. With that, if you could introduce yourself, give us a brief synopsis of the firm, and then take us through your slides, please.
Certainly. Mr. Chair, thank you. For the record, my name is Janik Mayer. I am a manager in the upstream and gas practice at PFC Energy and project manager for this engagement that we are undertaking for the Alaska State Legislature, providing support with analysis for oil and gas fiscal terms reform.
And before he starts, maybe you want to define for us, since we're a fishing state, although monetarily maybe an oil state, but there's a lot of fishermen around the coast, define what upstream is. Because,
thank you, Mr. Chair. Upstream is a term used in the industry to refer to all activities from the initial phases of exploration through to development of projects, through to production of crude oil. It essentially differentiates all of those activities from downstream activities, which is everything onward from the point that crude oil is produced to where it is refined, turned into things like refined products like gasoline, kerosene, a range of petrochemical products. So upstream is everything that went into producing the crude oil as opposed to producing the refined products.
Thank you.
Good. I'll have my colleague introduce himself and perhaps say a little bit about PFC Energy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Gerald Kepis. I'm a partner at PFC Energy and head of our upstream and gas practice. PFC Energy is a oil and gas expertise consultancy. We have clients all over the globe, private sector operators, national oil companies, and government entities. And we're delighted to be able to hear to present our results. Thank you.
And Gerald, maybe for tonight, could you maybe pull your mic a little bit closer, because some of us are a little hard of hearing, and you speak real soft. And
we
don't want to miss anything you say.
Thank you, sir. And if I need to repeat any of that, I'd be happy to do so. Thank you for having us here.
Mr. Chair, you asked us to go through a couple of things this evening, one being something that's been in most drafted this bill, which is the question of the decline curve, how that decline curve actually works, and then the other is some of the changes that have gone into the thresholds at which progressivity is triggered both for new and for incremental production. So I'll start, if I may, with that decline curve question. What you see on the screen in front of you is a sort of approximated analysis taking Department of Natural Resources production data up to the most recent point at which that's available, which at this point is 2010. And for each of the assets, multiplying that by the working interest that each of the three main companies has in those assets, and from that projecting forward a decline curve based on the methodology that is in the CS to see what that curve would look like. And so the idea behind the CS is that everything that's above that green wedge that you see in each of these cases that's projected out into the future, everything, any production above that level would receive the lower level of progressive tax on gross that is in the CS, and anything below that would receive the full rate that is capped at that maximum of 20%. There have been a number of questions about exactly how the decline rate is calculated and how the forward bending curve is calculated. So I just wanted to briefly explain that, because it's an extremely simple calculation that is exactly the same calculation that any of us use to calculate, for instance, mortgage payments on our houses or any of those things. So what you see here on the screen, for instance, since this calculation by the CS is done for each company, what you see is the approximate decline rate that taking this calculation on the basis of 2007 and 2010 would yield. The CS, of course, that requires that the calculation be done on the basis of 2008 and 2011 data. Since 2011 data isn't currently available, the next best thing is as an example, is to do it on 07 and 010 and 10 data. But the basic idea, there are two components. One is the question of how one calculates the decline rate. The other is the question of how one forecasts the curve forward. And essentially, those two things are the mirror image of each other. If we think for a moment about how the curve is forecast forward, if I start, for example, with a 6% decline rate on a production of 200,000 barrels a day, my target, if that's what I produced in 2011, then my target in 2012 is simply that 200,000 barrels a day times by 94%, 94% being 1 minus my 6% decline rate. In 2013, my target is my 2012 target, again multiplied by 94%. In 2014, my target is my 2013 target multiplied by 94%. It's as simple as that. Now, mathematically, one can express that in a single equation, which is simply saying, take that decline rate and raise it to the power of the difference between the current year and 2011, and that's doing exactly that same thing. It's simply, essentially, compounding the effect of that decline, so the decline, essentially, in each year gets, in absolute terms, slightly smaller as the base on which it's being calculated gets slightly smaller, and that's exactly how that curve works, and it works. The math is exactly the same as the math in calculating interest on one's own mortgage. For more technical purposes, it also, as a curve, is almost indistinguishable, for instance, from doing this as one might if one were to take a more technical approach and do this as an exponential decline. That would be some slightly more complicated math to put into the bill, but the end result is essentially indistinguishable. So we went for an approach that's as simple as possible.
Just a quick correction, just because I think there was a misspeak. It's the inverse of the of time. Not to the power, inverse of the power, one over time.
The curve forecast forward is to the power of the year. Right. When looking back and calculating the decline rate, is the inverse. But right. In looking forward, in calculating the curve out, it's raised to the power of the number of years. As you say, Mr. Chair, in then calculating the question of, well, what is the decline rate? It's the exact inverse of that calculation. So when it's simply, in this case, taking a fixed number of years, in this case 2011 and 2008, so three time periods, and saying what's the difference in those two numbers, we'll put the later number over the first number and raise it to the inverse of the number of years and calculate what that effective decline rate is between those four. And it's just doing exactly the opposite of what we did when we forecasted the curve forward. And again, it's the same math that goes with calculating one's effective interest rate on a mortgage payment.
There was just a, what I had asked Janik to do this evening was to put the slide up here with the production numbers on it and kind of go over the decline curve calculation. There's been a lot of discussion and I think they, and some of it have mystified the formula when it's pretty straightforward. It's easier to think of it as just virtually like compounding interest, a compounded rate, except it's going backwards. It's dropping. But anyway, it might help think of it in that term more than the way it's written in the bill, because for conceptual purposes. And we've talked a lot about a 6% decline curve. We talk about it in average rather than breaking it down per company in the discussion for simplicity. Just to make sure everybody's clear. Do we have any questions with that? We'll go into slide number 3.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. The remaining slides in the deck focus on the economics of how changes to the rates that apply to new development and to incremental production, that is to say production from the legacy fields above that decline rate we've just discussed, how that rate is applied, and in particular changes that have occurred in this most recent draft of the CS and what they look like. Now, I'll start with an example which is not the CS, but coming back to the question of the current system of ACEs and what it looks like for a particularly expensive new development. There's been a lot of discussion about costs and in particular the concern about the fact that, in particular, in moving to the gross, that one increases the sensitivity of the tax to costs, both in terms of OPEX and CAPEX. And also a lot of discussion for much of the process of these committee hearings on the question of the fact that new development, both in completely new areas and also a lot of the more challenged potential developments in the legacy fields, are very high cost and needing to be able to incentivize those. So, for instance, if we look at cash flows of a possible sort of new development with capital expenses as high as $34 a barrel, and that's a particular figure that we're asked to run by a number of senators who've been given that figure by people currently developing very, very high cost, or looking at developing very high cost new reservoirs. Now, the economics of those look very challenged. This is something that essentially is NPV negative at even $100 a barrel. And again, under ACES faces very high rates of government take, ranging from 77% in this case over the life cycle at $100 a barrel through to as high as 84% in the at the levels above $200 a barrel at 220, 230. Now, it is indeed true, as we heard testimony on Friday from Department of Revenue from BP, and again, as I've given testimony as well, that under the structure of moving things to the gross, that high-cost fields with nothing else done can, in fact, look even worse, precisely because of that sensitivity when the tax is done on the net that we've discussed. And that's why it's particularly important that if one is to go this rate, that not only is that compensated for, but that there are, should be significantly lower rates that apply to new development, not only to compensate for that effect, but to provide significant incentive for these high-cost new projects, both projects that are new areas and sort of projects above that sort of 6% decline that we've talked about out of the existing legacy fields. So in this case, as we can see, if we do nothing other than apply that maximum of 20% rate on the gross to this expensive new development, we get even higher. We have lower levels of government take, but we have even worse economics because the tax, incidence of the tax in those first years when costs are the highest, particularly when there's both ongoing drilling costs that you see in the cash flow chart on the top left, mean that there is a higher incidence of tax in those crucial first years, crucial in particular for economic metrics like NPV and IRR. And so the economics of the project actually deteriorate when faced with that maximum rate. When, however, we drop that rate to the lower maximum of 5% for 7 years, we get a marginal improvement, so the economics in this case look better than they did under ACES. Government take is certainly significantly lower than once one gets sort of above $120 a barrel in oil prices, is significantly lower than it was for ACES. But this is still a very challenged development, still NPV negative at a 10% discount rate, and is not something that would meet anyone's hurdle rate for capital, let alone be competitive with other potential projects. So what are the things that we can do to further stimulate that, to further improve these economics? Well, within this structure, the furthest we could go is one could say simply there's absolutely no progress at all, for instance, on new development. Short of doing that, there are a number of other things that we can do. One, for instance, and what the thing that is perhaps the most significant would be extending the period for which that 5% rate applies. So in this case, what the CS does is it extends it from 7 years out to 10 years. And when we do that, what we see is a reasonably significant further drop in the rates of government take. So we're now down to essentially close to a flat 70% and even dropping off slightly below that at the highest price levels. And we've reduced that negative net present value from about negative 50 to negative 34 in this case. Still not a great project, but getting better compared to where it was previously. The next thing that one can do, other than extending it further for further years of time, is also look at the question of what are the price levels at which progressivity kicks in. In the previous draft of the CS, that kicked in at the $60 level, and progressivity then built from that point on in that first five-year period to a maximum of 5%. What one can instead do is move that up. So in this case, what the CS does is it moves that all the way up to $90 in that first five-year period, so that the maximum 5% tax rate in that 10-year period applies. Progressivity starts at the $90 threshold, continues up to $150, I guess, and then tapers off. It starts at the $90 threshold, I misspeak, and continues up simply until it reaches it continues at that 0.5% rate until it reaches the 5% maximum. As we can see, that further improves the economics of a particularly challenged project like this. It's still NPV negative, but it's a lot less so than it was at the outset. We've taken government take now down to levels where it's below 70% for most of the time, though it gets to 70% in the sort of $140 range. And that's where the CS that we have on the table stands on new development. One of the things you'll notice in looking at...
If you can hold it there for a minute, Senator Ellis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A question has come to the table from one of my colleagues asking if we adopt this approach, on the decline curve, on how much oil will the big three pay the top rate in 2025? Is it close to 227,000 barrels?
I think they'd probably have to calculate that, but they can answer that question.
Senator Ellis, the Chair, I can't answer that question right at the moment, but I'd be very happy to do that calculation after this and provide an answer. At least as good an answer as is possible based on the available data from the Department of Revenue in terms of forecasts. That may not, in fact, be sufficient to provide a concrete answer to that, but I can do our best.
Senator McGuire.
Thank you, through the Chair. One other thing, Janik, I'd love to see. We've had discussions in our offices about, after the 10-year period, whether or not it would be worthwhile to, I mean, one idea would be to eliminate the 10-year cap at all. People at this table know I'd prefer that, but that said, the art of compromise after 10 years, why not then, what rate do you think it'll revert to, I guess? And part of that's going to be where the decline curve, I guess, sits at that moment.
Under the CS, the rate it refers to is the full 20% maximum.
Okay, and so I'd just like people to consider that one opportunity would be to have it reduced not instead to the original rate, but rather to the the next level, the aggregate level. I guess I worry that people make investment decisions based on 10 years and then they go all the way back to that higher amount. But I'm wondering how it really plays out.
Could you address Senator McGuire's question and maybe add to it the impact on the timing of the cash flows as we move from 7 to 10 years, so I think people would get a better feel for the magnitude as we looked at moving different levers to move these economic terms more positive.
And I didn't mean aggregate, but incremental. My apologies.
Senator McGuire, through the chair. To further improve things, there are a number of things that one can do. In many ways, as you say, the simplest is to get rid of the time limit altogether or to extend it further. There, one could, as you say, also have the rate for incremental production apply after that time. That starts, having these three tiers is already a relatively complex arrangement that starts to add complexity. I'd say two things in response to that. One is that the biggest impact, of course, is in the from a perspective of economic metrics, is in the earlier years of production. Inherently, the nature of time value of money and discounting in measuring economic value in that sense is that what happens in the first 10 years is the most crucial. But that said, as we saw in extending this from 7 years to 10 years, that had a significant impact. If one didn't want to get rid of the limit altogether but wanted to provide an additional benefit, my suggestion is it would probably be easier to keep extending that time period further rather than to play with the rate that applies at the end of it, simply from a complexity point of view.
Thinking, just one more point, I guess my point is this, just thinking about it logically, what I don't want to end up doing is what I like about the bill, we've made big movement in this area, and this is what we want, new oil into the Trans-Alaska pipeline, into our systems. What I don't want to do is penalize people, I guess you could use that term, by saying after 10 years, we're going to actually give you a worse rate than those who have made an incremental oil development increase. And I guess that's the only thing. And I understand your point about it being complex. And at one point, we actually ran numbers to try and just amalgamate the two. But there are concerns within the body about the differences between, you know, the heavy CapEx costs associated with brand new development. And I agree it's in the first 10 years, and it's just something to think about that after 10 years, then you would revert right back then again to the initial rate as opposed to that more favorable rate that somebody who has arguably had lower CapEx costs is now getting that incremental rate. So it's just something to think about.
And if you could maybe give the committee a rough idea on the sensitivity of the $34 CapEx if the firm had $30 CapEx or $28 CapEx, just kind of a general, I don't know if you can calculate it, but just a general feeling this evening, how that would move those incremental numbers, say at $100 NPV.
Certainly, Mr. Chair, what I can say is that in working with this profile of capital cost and production, and in preparing some of these slides, we certainly, for instance, ran one at $17 a barrel and had something that was NPV positive and I think made maybe a 16 or a 17% rate of return. So about the level that the one would require to at least pass the threshold hurdle rate, though again possibly not something that's going to set the world ablaze in terms of competitiveness for capital on an international basis. As capital costs rise, those NPVs, those IRRs come down. But I would also caution that, you know, this is a very stylized project. The actual spending profiles and production profiles of anything that's currently being considered are more nuanced than that, and there is a huge amount of sensitivity to all of those things as well. So just because one sees a particular NPV and IRR value here doesn't mean that necessarily is indicative of what a particular project being considered by a range of companies at the moment is. The idea of these analyses is to provide indicative ideas of sensitivities to, you know, as you change government take, how does that move things, and what direction does that move things, not to say that this is competitive or that isn't. And in general, I think most of these higher cost new development stylized projects we've been looking at are ones that either would only just meet a hurdle rate for capital in the best sense, let alone be competitive. So in that sense, any of the lower rates that we're looking at for new development certainly are an improvement over races, but I would suggest for many of the high-cost developments don't necessarily get to the point of making them competitive for capital, necessarily. That may be more the case at toward the $17 barrel to $20 barrel end of the spectrum than it is towards the $30-plus dollar barrel end of the spectrum.
Okay. Go ahead and continue.
One more thing, Mr. Chair, you'll notice on this and the previous couple of slides is that when we look at level and composition of government take in these examples, despite having moved the threshold up, for instance, in this case, to $90, you'll see the severance tax, the progressive tax on gross, still kicking in above that $60 level in the charts here and similarly represented in the production tax numbers that you see there. The reason for that, of course, is that these are undiscounted figures going across the full 30-year life cycle of this project, and so once that 10-year window has expired, there is indeed progressive severance tax at those levels, and that's why you see that in those charts. The fact of that 10-year limit also means that in the case of a new development, it's a little less sensitive to movement in that threshold than, and as we'll get to in a moment, when one moves that threshold for the incremental production, where because there's no time limit on the different rate for the incremental production, moving that threshold has a greater effect because it's not subject to the 10-year time limit. So to once again look at a higher cost new development in this case, assuming $25 a barrel in capital costs for an incremental development, lower than we saw in the previous case because by definition an incremental development is going to be in an existing area, able to use at least some existing infrastructure, but I think $25 a barrel capex is certainly not out of the range of some of the things that we would imagine for some of the more economically challenged projects that are proposed at the moment. What we see here under ACES, given this particular profile of production, of capital spending, is against, in this case, something that is NPV positive at $100 a barrel, but only barely, and gets sort of about an 11% rate of return. Once again, if such a project were put under the full 20% maximum rate that applies under CSSB 192. In this case, we actually have relatively little change in the economic metrics, at least $100 a barrel. What we do get is an overall reduction in government take at those higher levels, but again, not much change at the $100 a barrel level. As we've seen, the structure essentially is very close to equivalent, and in some cases, in some high-cost cases, marginally worse at those price levels. We have, in this case, a lower tax burden and slightly higher cash flow at the tail end of production, where one doesn't have the capital costs, all one has is operating costs and perhaps a little bit of maintenance capex, but a slightly higher tax burden and slightly lower cash flow in the early years, where costs are higher compared to the averages that we've been looking at, and on which the system is essentially calibrated. When one applies instead the 10% maximum rate that applies to new production above that decline curve, the economics start to get certainly noticeably better. We're now further into positive NPV territory. We're up to a 13% internal rate of return, though once again, at that level, possibly not even able to surpass a hurdle rate for capital within a company, let alone the question of being competitive with other projects on a broader level. But we brought the government takedown where it's uniformly starts with something in the 60s rather than the 70s. It's still getting up to 68 or 69% in most of these cases, but significantly lower than it would be under ACES in most of those cases. If what we then do, and what the CS does is move this to the $75 level in terms of that threshold at which progressivity under that 10% maximum rate kicks in. I don't have a slide for 75 exactly, but I have one for 70 and for 80, and the result is, of course, essentially halfway in between. When we move it up to 70 here, because there is no time limit on that, you'll see in the chart on the bottom right that progressive severance tax, the tax on gross, now kicks in only above the $70 level rather than above the $60 level. And if we move it all the way up to 80, we're reducing government take again that bit further. So, for instance, at the $100 level, we now have government take around 63% and improve the economic metrics again that little bit further. So now we have at $100 for this hypothetical reference project, a positive NPV of about $100 million and an IRR of 14%. Again, just approaching a basic hurdle rate for capital, not necessarily highly competitive on a broader basis, but an improvement from where we started.
We have questions for PFC this evening? Okay, seeing none, thank you for doing these slides, and I'd like to ask you to go ahead and make one at 75.
Certainly, Mr. Chair.
Which would be pretty easy to do, and then we'll get that distributed to the committee. Maybe we can have that in the morning, if possible. Any further comments, concerns, questions? Senator Hoffman.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I move the Senate Finance Committee.
Wait, excuse me, 1 second. I've got three fiscal notes in your packet. One fiscal note from the Department of Revenue for $13,530,500 in general funds for 8 new full-time positions. One fiscal note from the Department of Natural Resources for $957,400 in general funds for 8 new full-time positions. One fiscal note from the Department of Administration for the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission for $150,000 in general funds for 1 new contract position. And we have previously had public testimony on this bill. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move the Senate Finance Committee pass CS for Senate Bill 192 with individual recommendations, accompanying fiscal notes to the next committee of referral.
We have a motion to move the bill from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes. Do we have objection? Seeing none, we'll go ahead and move the bill from committee to the next committee of referral. Next meeting will be 9 a.m. tomorrow morning. We'll post the agenda. Meeting adjourned.